Welcome to part 4 of the PDH online course on NFPA 72-07. At the conclusion of the preceding section, we had just gone through fire alarm riser diagram notes, and we said there was a little more text to cover. The notes for this project are not identified as notes. However, they introduce three important details not found in later notes examples: the duct detector test station, continued operation of the fire alarm system, of the existing fire alarm system, and auditorium egress lighting. A change in the fire alarm code requires remote test stations for duct detectors that are not readily accessible. They are available in many forms, but most contain a test switch and a reset switch. They're part of the duct detector, not part of the fire alarm system. The note calls them out correctly, but the riser diagram shows them incorrectly. Continued operation of the existing fire alarm system is required for occupied spaces and construction spaces. The requirement is usually ignored because wiring is ripped out during demolition and new temporary wiring must be run to provide detectors and pull stations. Temporary wiring must be ripped out when the building is turned over to the owner. Expensive and more expensive. Second reason for ignoring the requirement for an operable fire alarm during construction is construction dust. It trips smoke detectors. For small construction jobs, the smoke detectors are bagged and taken out of service. They're still connected. They're supposed to be replaced by heat detectors. Auditorium egress lighting triggered by the fire alarm is a relatively new requirement. Inspectors are beginning to require it and verify that it's installed. Unfortunately, there are complications which cause it to be disabled shortly after test. Concept behind the requirement is that the audience should be able to exit the auditorium when the fire alarm sounds. During a performance, the auditorium is dark. The emergency lights will not come on because they only respond to power failure. The fire alarm authorities responded by requiring that house lights come up to full brightness upon receipt of a fire alarm. Unfortunately, most fire alarms occur when there's not a show in progress. The fire alarm doesn't know. All it knows is that the house lights must come up to full brightness. After several misoperations of this type, the fire alarm lighting control is disabled. Fire alarm drawing notes. A construction drawing usually requires general notes and keyed notes. General notes are assumptions made by the designer which should be known to the installer. In addition, problems with previous jobs can be avoided by stating the clarification that came up during that previous job. Below is a sample set of general notes for a fire alarm riser diagram. And this is called Addressable Fire Alarm System Typical Riser Notes. And that's the way it was on the construction drawing that was issued. I just copied this. I didn't relabel it. This riser represents a typical system not intended for installation. System supplier shall provide installation drawings and schematic wiring diagrams. Now, that's not quite correct. He's supposed to provide interconnection wiring diagrams. Difference between schematic wiring diagrams and interconnection wiring diagrams is we use a one-line representation on a schematic, and we just say, go into this box. On an interconnection wiring diagram, we split out the individual conductors and show them connected to individual terminals. This is kind of important because on a lot of equipment, there are more terminals than there are wires. And there are many reasons this comes about. One is that you use the same enclosure for a lot of different devices. Some of the devices require more terminals than others. So you have spare terminals. You always make the box for the biggest one that's going to go in the box. So it's common to have spare terminals. On the interconnection or connection diagram, you show people which terminals are used and which are left not connected. Exact system requirements shall be coordinated with the system supplier. And again, this comes from the factory, and they do a good job. Just in my experience, they consistently do a good job. System supplier shall supervise installation, program and test of system, instruct owner on system operation. We're getting in current specifications to put a separate specification section on testing and startup, sometimes called commissioning. There is a separate PDH course on specifications, which I recommend strongly. The world is changing, and you want to issue the best stuff that's out there. You don't want your job to be less complete than what another design house does. So if it is convenient to your plans, consider taking the specification course that PDH offers also. All fire alarm wiring shall be in 1/2-inch conduit. Real bad idea. Don't say half-inch conduit. Two reasons. First, half-inch, little piddling stuff, and it doesn't have room if there are too many runs in there. It's a violation of the code to tell him to put too many wires in a half-inch conduit. If you said all fire alarm wiring shall be in rigid metal conduit, that would be a much better statement. And rigid metal is better than just saying conduit, because they got some new plastic conduits out there that are probably not a good idea for firearms. All wiring shall be verified with system supplier prior to bid. Provide additional monitor and control modules as recommended by the system supplier. What's a monitor module? What's a control module? Those are multiplexers. Again, this was when we were first starting to do the digital addressable systems. And to split out wiring to run an elevator, there are wires that go both ways on an elevator. You got to tell the elevator that the fire alarm is alarming. You want the fire alarm to know that there's a problem on the elevator. In order to make these connections, you have to have some multiplexers to get onto the digital communication circuit. And in this set of documentation, they called them monitor modules and control modules. We'll see later on people are using simplex multiplexer notation because, again, in my part of the country, we buy an awful lot of simplex systems, and the simplex salesman helps us write the specification. We end up using his words, and again, everybody understands the simplex words because they're almost universal around here, even if you buy the system from somebody else. All control cabinets shall be grounded per the National Electric Code requirements and per the specifications. Coordinate city tie-in requirements with the local authority. That's a wonderful line. There used to be city alarm systems where they actually ran a wire around the city and you tied into it and you put your click, click, clicks on it, just like the pull stations at the corner of Main and Market Street put click, click, clicks on it. And that's what this says when it says the city tie-in. And we don't do that anymore. No, city doesn't let you touch their wires. Absolutely not. Don't even want you to call into their phone numbers. We hook up our fire alarms to a central monitoring station. The code requires central monitoring. They want to make sure that somebody responds when the system goes into alarm. They want to make sure that somebody can check to see if it's a false alarm before bothering the fire department. So the code requires a central monitoring connection, which is almost always a third-party commercial entity. Some communities, and this is becoming more and more rare, will let you dial in to their dispatcher, but this runs their trucks out to find out you got a false alarm. Much better to run out a central monitoring facility truck to see if there's a problem. And I'm not saying that's how they respond to it. The central monitoring facilities have a lot of detailed requirements that are specified in this code we're not going to talk about. But they do a good job, and that's the way the city wants to do it, and it's a good way for the owner to do it. Refer to specification section 16.7.21 for additional requirements. Refer to drawings for device quantities and locations. So this tells you the period. This was back when we used the 16,000 series for electrical specifications. We're using the 26,000 series today. There are always questions of style and preference in design. These show up in notes as well. Note 3 calls half-inch conduit. Many designers feel that concealed conduit should be a minimum of 3/4-inch in EMT or RGS. That's electrical metallic tubing thin wall conduit, or RGS rigid galvanized steel thick wall conduit. Increased material cost is not associated by increased labor, provides capacity for future expansion or accommodation of future technology. The importance of the note is the requirement for conduit forbidding open wiring, which is very, very much less expensive. Another preference and style question is the term conduit. Contractors and inspectors are beginning to accept flexible non-metallic conduit, commonly called Smurf tube. It has no structural strength, and the corrugations fight future cable pulls. EMT, thin wall steel tubing, and RGS, heavy wall steel pipe, increase survivability of the alarm installation. Note 6 refers to tie-in, and we just figured out what that meant. There is a requirement usually ignored of providing heat detectors and pull stations during construction. Another requirement often ignored of hiring 24/7 monitoring facility for every fire alarm system. There's a requirement for approval by the fire department or building inspector for the system. Keyed notes are usually associated with numbers and a special symbol, such as a hex box. Usually the number in the hex box is on the drawing near something that needs explaining. A list of keyed notes is on the right margin with each of the explanation. Keyed notes work very well for busy drawings. However, they add a layer of complication, which is avoided by text directly on the drawing and a leader connecting to the item in question. A problem which arises with notes on the margin is when a job has many sheets or a second sheet is added to a simple job. Do you repeat all the keyed notes on the additional pages? If you do not, it makes it hard for an installer who is working in the area not containing the notes on his sheet. A set of kitchen notes are illustrated below. The contractor shall furnish, install, and wire kitchen hood light switch, fan switch, and wiring among panel switches, J-box, kitchen hood, coordinate with kitchen equipment contractor. Provide 120-volt, 20-amp circuit for fire suppression panel. Now we're getting interested. Provide annunciator wiring between building alarm panel and kitchen hood fire suppression panel. Provide octagonal box, 54-inch above finished floor, with 3/4-inch conduit, run 6 inches inside ceiling. For exact location and size, coordinate with kitchen equipment contractor. I haven't seen an octagonal box specified or installed in this century. Well, next time I'm in Lowe's, I'll see if they still sell them. I don't get into the electrical supply houses as often as I used to. Provide back boxes for solenoid valve and switch. Provide power wiring conduit for disposer from panel to J-box. Coordinate with kitchen contractor. These are clearly kitchen things. I wonder what disposer is. Sure sounds like a garbage disposal, but I can't. I mean, that's not part of the fire alarm system. Very interesting things happen in kitchen fire suppression systems. Furnish, install, and connect disconnect switches for roll-in convection oven with associated wiring between panel and disconnect switches. I know, this has nothing to do with the fire alarm. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. That thing we were talking about, the disposer, it had a thing about a solenoid valve. Solenoid valve is very, very common. When the kitchen suppression system goes off, you shut off the gas. Doesn't that sound like a good idea? Let's not feed the fire we're trying to put out. Even worse, let's not put out the fire and fill the room with unignited methane. Oh, but and then they talk about the disposal connections in the same note. Yes, kitchens are interesting. Electrical contractor shall provide shunt trip breakers for cooking equipment under the hoods and for the hood lights. This gets into one of those hairy questions. Do you turn off the hood lights or not when there's a suppression operation? Some authorities having jurisdiction say turn them off. Some say leave them on. But there's wiring required by the contractor, and that's what we're telling him here. Replace existing panel K with new panel K1. Reconnect existing circuits. This doesn't sound like fire alarm stuff. And the last note is not fire alarm either. So we got some interesting kitchen notes here and some questions that we should be aware of if we get involved in this. Be aware of the breakdown in responsibility. Typically, the mechanical engineer buys the kitchen suppression panel. What? We're hooking it up to shut off the power to the burners and the ovens, and a mechanical engineer is buying it? Yes, that's the way it's done, because it looks like a mechanical system. You got this big old tank of stuff, and it dumps into the hood. The hood was a mechanical device, and the big old tank of stuff and piping sounds like mechanical devices. Sure, there's a solenoid that trips the thing into operation, and as we mentioned, there's a solenoid that shuts off the gas line. So there is a electrical requirement, and it has to be coordinated, but it's not an electrical installation. Same thing on underfloor computer systems. Computers sound electrical, don't they? No, they're mechanical systems. Wait a minute. What's going on here? Well, it's part of the air conditioning, and the air conditioning in a computer room is very, very complicated. They generate tremendous amounts of heat, and they have to generate tremendous amounts of cooling to keep the equipment in operation. So just about universally, you have a big floor-mounted air conditioner in the computer room. And the purpose of the underfloor suppression system is to shut off that cooling system so you're not blowing toxic fumes around when there's a fire, and to dump this stuff so you put out the fire before you damage things. And it just becomes a mechanical device. The mechanical engineer buys the underfloor suppression system, and we have to hook into it. And we have to hook into it for two reasons. First, because you got to turn off the fans, and turning off the fans is usually an electrical requirement. It's becoming more and more mechanical as these things become computerized. The air conditioner is a computer, and the underfloor suppression device is a computer, and having the two computers talk to each other sounds like an electrical task, but it's a mechanical task because you buy them from two mechanical contractors. Another of the requirements for computer room protection is you shut off the power to the computers. Boy, does that make the computer guy mad. They don't like turning off power to the computers. They don't like a controlled power down situation, but even more, they don't like an external power interruption. And it's a mechanical function. Why is this? Well, the computer guy buys a computer power distribution unit, which is called a computer power distribution unit. Really, on the drawing, you'll see a PDU. It's a power distribution unit, and it's not bought by the electrical contractor. It's bought by the information technology group. We bring up three wires, a lot of times 220-208 circuit, and they distribute their own power under the floor to their computer systems. And it'll have two wires for connection to the fire alarm system because they know it has to be shut down. They really don't want to hook up those wires, but they know it has to be shut down. And if the mechanical guy buys his underfloor suppression system and hooks up his wire to the fan, he's supposed to hook up wires to the power distribution unit also, without the electrical contractor having anything to do with it. Commercial kitchens require special fire suppression and fire alarm equipment. There is an expectation that the fire will occur under the exhaust hood and possibly ignite condensed grease in the exhaust duct. The general form of suppression is a mechanical system where a fusible link releases a valve and a suppressant powder or gas is released. Normal form is a mechanical pull station to be available to manually release the valve also. Local fire marshal has preferences on automatically turning off the lights under the hood, stopping the fan, cutting off gas and electrical appliances under the hood. And when I say this, that means somebody has to check with the local fire department on how they want it done. It is not a hassle to the contractor. It's not a hassle to the designer. You just have to find out for sure how they want it done. The building fire alarm does not trip the suppression system. The fire alarm system does receive alarm information from the suppression system. It can be programmed for a local evacuation or building-wide evacuation at the preference of the fire marshal. Note 2 above refers to the suppression system telling the fire alarm what is going on. The fire alarm installer must provide a supervised input relay for this purpose. Fire alarm riser should show the connection. Note 3 refers to a solenoid valve on fuel gas. Note does not tell the contractor to provide a circuit from the suppression system to the valve and does not identify the power source for the valve. And if these aren't on the drawing, the guy's not going to include them in his bid, and he's going to call it a change order. Note 5 refers to cutoff of cooking equipment under the hoods and hood lights. It would be good to identify the power source and the suppression system as the control. Sometimes shunt trip breakers will not fit in standard power panels. It's the contractor's duty to provide the specified function, but it would be good for the designer to see if an external shunt trip circuit breaker is required. Specifications. Specifications for fire alarm systems are more fluid than one might suspect. The first variable is which contractor provides and installs the system. The riser notes above refer to specification 16721. This is in Division 16,000 Electrical. However, specification 13851 contains the same title, headings, and contacts. It is in Division 13,000 Special Construction. It is important to include only one specification for the fire alarm. Why do I say this? Why would we even bother mentioning this? Because so often specifications are the poor cousin of a construction project. We work so hard on figuring out what we're building. We work so hard on the drawings. Oh yeah, we've got to issue specifications. So the night before the package goes out, people put together the specifications. And too often, I apologize this to the world at large, we don't check them before they go out. I have seen jobs where we've issued both a fire alarm in Division 16,000 and a fire alarm in Division 13,000, and we shouldn't do that. It's been warned here. Also, we should read them over, see if it looks like English, and you know if the editing has been correctly implemented. A new PDH course, Electrical Construction Specifications, discusses specifying and the new CSI Division 26,000 for electrical. The conventional form for a large construction project is for the electrical contractor to run the conduit and wires and install the bases for sensors and notification devices. The electrical contractor hires a fire alarm installer to do detailed design, get the permits, provide and install the fire alarm control panel and devices. The fire alarm installer is responsible for witness tests and documentation, which can be a substantial undertaking. On a fire alarm renovation project, it's common to bid the jobs to fire alarm installers and let them sub out the pipe and wire installation. The next level of fluidity in fire alarm specification is level of detail. It's completely workable and appropriate to specify a fire alarm in a one-paragraph note on a plan drawing. A sample follows. Contractor to provide and install addressable analog fire alarm system, including pull stations, smoke detectors, heat detectors, notification devices, annunciator at entrance, an outside strobe, and alarm bell. Contractor to arrange permits and inspections and make any changes required by authority having jurisdiction without additional cost to the owner. Heat detectors are not usually required, so this spec tells the contractor that more than minimal protection is envisioned. If there is no heat detector in the utility room when the designer reviews submittal drawings, he can justifiably complain that the contractor was informed that heat detectors were required. The wording addressable analog forces the contractor to buy a modern digital system. The outside strobe and horn are required in some locations and cannot be an extra cost item if this wording is used. The specific listing of permits, inspections, and changes avoids change orders, which too often result from a very detailed specification which lacks general language. For all alarm systems, the authority having jurisdiction makes the final decisions. This wording helps get the design through plans review at the local building department and helps get a good system installed. A more detailed but still clear and fairly short specification is now included. This is one page and It's brief beyond belief, almost more brief than the one paragraph. This is called Section 16620. Isn't it amazing that we can have all these different numbers for the same thing? Fire alarm slash detection system, Part 1, General. Section includes fire alarm system and components. Quality assurance, NFPA 70, the National Electric Code, Underwriters Laboratory. Products, materials, addressable fully electronic, main fire alarm control panel with remote LED display annunciator, synchronized strobes, non-electronic framed plexiglass annunciator with floor plan and room numbers. Part 3, execution, installation, design and install per NFPA requirements. Wiring to be installed in conduit. End of section. That is the entire specification. The specification comes from the School Design Guide published by a state funding commission in the Midwest. The elements thought important enough to be included in this short document are interesting. Section 2 refers to the National Electric Code without mentioning a year. Different states and communities have adopted different editions of the National Electric Code. I've been told that some townships in western states do not follow any version of the National Electric Code. And it's not clear what this wording contributes. Requiring compliance with the 2002, 2005, or 2008 National Electric Code would have been more enforceable. Section 2 refers to Underwriters Laboratory, and they spell underwriters wrong. It's similarly vague. It's important to have a system of components certified to work together. The wording used permits sensors and notification devices from one vendor to be connected to a panel from another vendor. Steady-state characteristics of remote devices are well-defined, but the transient characteristics during switching on and off are not published. Compatibility can only be determined by test. Notable exceptions are duct detectors and outside weatherproof bells. These components are not made by fire alarm vendors and have a proven record of compatibility. Section 2 requirement for an LED graphic annunciator is a repudiation of current technology. 20 years ago, detectors were connected in a group for several rooms or one floor. This was electrically a zone. Any activated sensor was reported as residing in a particular zone. No further information was available electrically. An alarm for the zone was issued. This matches the idea of an LED being associated with a physical area, and such an annunciator was easy. Today, each sensor has a digital address. The fire alarm control panel knows exactly which detector has been activated. An alpha display usually tells in English the location of the detector. This is forbidden by the state specification. Well, forbidden isn't the correct word. An LED graphic annunciator must be provided, and the state will not pay for an alpha display. The requirement for conduit was discussed earlier on riser diagrams. Third level of detail for a fire alarm specification is a call out of details of construction for each of the components and wiring methods. Typically, this is a 30-page specification provided by the vendor. It specifies proprietary technology, excludes competitors, even if followed by the words or equal. Surprisingly, long detailed specifications are used on most major construction projects. The bidders ignore the proprietary detail. The designer ignores the proprietary detail. The construction manager ignores the proprietary detail. The inspector ignores the proprietary detail. But a good system is installed, accepted by the inspector, and works reliably for 20 years. We're going to talk a little bit about battery sizing and voltage drop calculations. It's going to be very, very little, but that'll be in the next section. Let's take a break now.